I've been hoping for many years that we could have something of this nature at the at an ARSC meeting, dealing with the country music field and some very important work that's going on there. We happen to be close to Nashville and have several representatives of the Country Music Foundation with us today. I will give you a short synopsis of each of them. The paper, the principal paper, has been prepared by Bob Pinson, who unfortunately cannot be here today. He is head of the acquisitions department at the Country Music Foundation. He's been a private collector for many years and has contributed discographies to a number of books, also to a number of publications, Old Time Music, Tony Russell's publication, Disc Collector, Record Research, and others. And he's produced reissue LPs for various major labels, Victor, MGM, and other labels. He's well known in the field. I regret that he could not be with us, but you will hear his paper, which will be read by Ronnie Pugh, who is the reference librarian at the Country Music Foundation. His master's thesis was on the career of Ernest Tubb, and he's also been active in writing liner notes and contributing to publications such as the Journal of Country Music. Also on the panel, up here on stage, will be Tony Russell, who we're very happy to see here from England, who, in addition to being editor of Old Time Music, one of the leading publications in the country music research field, is the author of the book Blacks, Whites, and Blues. He's currently engaged in a mind-boggling endeavor to become the Brian Rust of the country music field, I guess you'd call it, prepare the first comprehensive discography of pre-World War II country music, which is a very tall order indeed, and he will tell us more about that. We're anxiously awaiting it. And also on the podium will be Kyle Young. Kyle is the head of Country Music Foundation Press and the editor of the Journal of Country Music, which is the official publication of the Country Music Foundation. So if the gentleman can come to the stage, please. Present to you Country Music Discography and Overview.
Bob Pinson's paper that I'm about to read is a historical overview of country music discography, how it began, and some of the types of discography that you'll still encounter today. When I finish, Kyle will speak next about a Journal of Country Music discographical projects and other things, and then Tony about his magnum opus. When Southern Music published the first Carter Family songbook in the summer of 1930, also contained within the folio was a complete listing of all Carter Family records released to date of publication, thus making it possibly the first complete country music artist-oriented discography to be printed outside the confines of a record company catalog. On the contents page appear most of the Victor Records release numbers, along with A and B side designations. And while this page's listings is discographically incomplete, you only have to flip the page to see a compilation of all remaining Carter Family recordings, along with some A and B side designations that were available but not represented in the songbook itself. The fact that the compiler chose to list most of the A and B side designations does make it a slight extension of a mere record catalog listing, and therefore lends credence to it as a discography. One might choose to toss it aside as mere advertising, however, rather than accept it as discography in its infancy. Less debatable, however, is the advent of the first country record collector's journal, Disc Collector, which premiered in early 1951. Edited by collector Joe Nicholas in Michigan's Upper Peninsula town of Palmer, the Mimeographed Quarterly, which became more of an occasional after the first seven issues, brought together a then small band of serious country music collectors in a way not unlike Record Changer magazine's uniting of jazz collectors years earlier. Nicholas had a serious approach to discography in mind almost from the outset and contacted well-known Los Angeles record collector, dealer, and discographer Will Roy Hearn about authoring a Sons of the Pioneers article and record listing for his new magazine. Hearn's reply of January 19th, 1951 to Nicholas's earlier letter was quite affirmative, as in paragraph 3 of the letter, he accepts the challenge by stating, "It looks like I'm your boy." Then, some 4 months later, on May 9th, 1951, Hearn writes to inform Nicholas that the article has been, and I quote, "whipped into reasonable shape," and that he was now presenting it for publication. Hearn's Sons of the Pioneers discography, appearing in the April, May, June 1951, or second, issue of Disc Collector, thus became the first seriously researched country music discography to be published. A sample page from this discography reveals Hearn's inclusion of song matrix data, but unfortunately, a lack of take information, personnel data, and recording dates. Hearn's primary background as a label numerical discographer is quite evident, as he chooses to format this discography in alphabetical order by label rather than a chronological sequencing by matrix numbers. Considering Hearn's personal preference for label research rather than artist discography, and coupling this with the fact that he was Disc Collector's only serious discographical contributor at this point, it is understandable that the magazine switched its emphasis from artist discography to label discography, commencing with the first installment of the Paramount 3000 series numerical in the fourth issue. Future issues would feature the Supertone 2000 series, the OK 45,000 series, and others. Hearn's chief method of compiling label numericals involved the typing of an index card for each record release he could document, such as these three examples of cards for Vocalion Records releases by the Sons of the Pioneers. Upon Hearn's death in 1978, his private discographic compilations, including over 150,000 file cards covering over two decades of records from 1920 to 1942, were donated to the John Edwards Memorial Foundation at UCLA, a nonprofit facility founded in 1962 to perpetuate the memory of the young Australian collector who had been killed at age 28 in an automobile accident near Sydney. Shown here on the cover of Disc Collector's short-lived sister publication, Country Directory, which premiered in November 1960, only 1 month before his death, Edwards had become interested in the American folk and country recordings as a youth when he heard a Carter Family record being played on a local Australian radio station. This led to his discovery that many such American recordings were readily available on Australian 78 RPM labels such as Regal Zonophone. With that knowledge, he eagerly pursued the collecting of these American performances, and by 1953, at the age of 21, Edwards had already amassed a collection of several hundred 78s of pre-war vintage. He developed an intense interest in Jimmy Rogers' recordings, and this compelled him to formulate a comprehensive Rogers discography, which was eventually published in the fall 1955 issue of International Discophile. a magazine edited by George Collings in Fresno, California. This was the first of several discographies Edwards compiled for various publications, ranging from Disc Collector to Caravan to Country and Western Spotlight. This publication, published in New Zealand by Garth Gibson, started in November 1955 and remains an active publication today. The John Edwards Memorial Foundation Quarterly serves as the most important publication in the United States for country music discographical research. Published initially as a newsletter in October 1965 under the co-editorship of Norman Cohen, who is in our audience today, and Ed Kahn, the publication's intent was to provide information about foundation activities and to make available certain raw research data as opposed to the publication of original articles. But after 12 issues as a newsletter, it was apparent that the original framework was being gradually discarded, and this prompted the title change to JEMF Quarterly in spring 1969. It has continued to publish on a regular basis under Norman Cohen's editorship ever since. In addition to the publishing of numerous discographies in the Quarterly itself, the JEMF occasionally publishes discographies as a part of their special series booklets, the first of which featured Ernest V. Pop Stoneman and was published in July 1968. Also of note is a special Jimmy Rogers annotated discography authored by the late recording artist Johnny Bond and published by the JEMF in 1978. In addition, Johnny's own autobiodiscography was published separately in 1976. To date, in one form or another, the JEMF has published more than 50 artist-oriented discographies, plus numerous others ranging from numerical checklists to more unique ones, such as this study by Ivan Tribe of songs about the Silver Bridge collapse. This disaster occurred to the U.S. Highway 35 bridge over the Ohio River, connecting Point Pleasant, West Virginia to Canoga, Ohio on December 15, 1967, resulting in 46 deaths. While Tribe's discography represents a compilation of various songs about a particular event, recordings of individual songs are occasionally documented too. A case in point can be found in Archie Greene's book, Only a Minor, published in 1972 as a part of the University of Illinois Press's Music in American Life series. Here we see Greene's discography of Vernon Dalhart's recordings of Dream of the Miner's Child. As you can see, the typically prolific Dalhart managed to record the song for 9 different companies in less than 100 days. How he apparently escaped recording it for Boston's Grey Gull complex of labels will forever remain a mystery. The musical genre approach to country music discography has also been attempted, such as this listing of bluegrass LPs, a 1971 Swedish publication by Urban Haglund and Lillies Olsen. A West German discographer is currently compiling a similar listing for Western Swing. The past decade has witnessed an increasing array of relevant publications. We can't begin to go into all of them here. The aforementioned University of Illinois Press published a comprehensive work on Bob Wills by Charles Townsend in 1976, and one on Jimmy Rogers by Nolan Porterfield in 1979. Chappell and Company published Johnny Bond's biodiscography on Tex Ritter in 1976, and most recently, a Bradley Kincaid source book by Loyal Jones has been published by the Berea College Appalachian Center in Berea, Kentucky. A most important research journal, Old Time Music, also debuted a decade ago. Edited by our guest on the panel today from London, Tony Russell, Old Time Music's total issues now number close to 36. For the past few years, in his spare time, Mr. Russell has been preparing his voluminous book manuscript on pre-war country music discography to be published by the Country Music Foundation Press, whose editor, Kyle Young, is also present and on our panel today. He's brought along some of the Country Music Foundation Press's discographical publications, and he will discuss the CMF, the Country Music Foundation's role in such publications, past and present. Now I'll turn this presentation over to Mr. Kyle Young.
Started in. Started in fall 1972, the Country Music Foundation Press's original purpose was to publish facsimile reprints of existing publications. Soon, by the summer, the CMF Press had expanded to oversee publication of a free quarterly called the Journal of Country Music. Its editor, William Ivey, modeled the journal after the Folklore and Folk Music Archivist, a publication of Indiana University's Archives of Traditional Music. The purpose of the Journal of Country Music was to combine Foundation news, it had to a certain extent taken over for the CMF's newsletter, with interpretive articles on country music and articles on the current methodology of the recording industry and music library field. In addition to its stated purpose, the next 6 years and 15 issues of the magazine saw 6 articles devoted entirely to primary information, such as radio transcription listings, station logbooks, fans logbooks, etc., and 3 discographies: Bob Wills on Columbia, 1935 to 47, the Delmore Brothers, a pre-war discography, and a bio-discography of Waylon Jennings. In January of 1978, the journal changed once again. Drastic modifications in its appearance were made, as well as a shift in editorial focus. There was a move away from jargon-filled scholarly articles and a move toward more popular pieces, such as current interviews and historical studies. Important to this new editorial mix, however, was the continued emphasis on publishing primary material, such as discography. To complement the journal's new editorial philosophy, a format for discography was devised intended to allow easy access for the more general JCM reader without sacrificing the detail demanded by the serious scholar or discographer. Over the last 6 issues, 2 discographies have been published: Old Time Tunes on Edison and Waylon Jennings, A Discographical Update. Already accepted and slated for publication are 2 more discographies, one on Hank Penny, the other on Ernest Tubb. Along the way, in 1973, the press had expanded further its original purpose. Folklorist Neil Rosenberg was anxiously searching for a publisher for his Bill Monroe discography. Bill Ivey, a former graduate school classmate and friend of Neil's, and now director of the Country Music Foundation, saw no reason why the CMF shouldn't foot the printing bill. No royalty agreement between author and publisher was struck. It wasn't even discussed. In fact, there wasn't even a contract. This rather casual decision on the part of the foundation's director further defined the role of the CMF press. The precedent was set. The press, much like a university press, was to be available to publish books not deemed suitable or desirable for publication by trade houses. And obviously, discographical studies fell squarely in this category. Today, though the CMF Press has some 7 titles to its credit, Bill Monroe, an illustrated discography by Neil Rosenberg, is the only book-length discography that the press has published. However, publishing Monroe made apparent that one, and most important, there was a market, granted a small one, for discographical studies, and two, that there are qualified, capable scholars like Rosenberg who will provide publishable manuscripts. In fact, currently in production at the press is something of a spin-off of the illustrated discography concept, a book called The Johnny Cash Sourcebook, 1955 to 1980. By combining a complete discographical section, including session dates, time, location, and personnel, master numbers, song titles, composer credits, release numbers, and pertinent session notes, with separate chapters documenting other aspects of Cash's career, such as recordings, TV shows, concert appearances, awards, honors, and films, it is hoped that the traditional market for the book will expand to embrace casual country fans, and particularly the hardcore Cash fan. Also included in the book is a biographical sketch geared to Cash's performance career and a bibliography, as well as photographs. Several other titles are presently planned for the Sourcebook series, including studies of Hank Williams by Bob Pinson and Ernest Tubb by Ronnie Pugh. Obviously, the press's greatest commitment and most significant contribution to discography is its upcoming publication of Tony Russell's Country Music Discography, 1922 to 1942. Knowing of Tony's outstanding work in the field via personal contact, word of mouth, and his publication, Old Time Music, in 1977, the foundation applied to the National Endowment for the Arts for a $15,000 matching grant to bring Tony to the U.S. for a five-month period to coordinate and assist his verification of entries and additions of new material through our library holdings, to facilitate contact with major collections and corporate archives, provide for preparation and typing of a draft manuscript, and prepare a limited edition of the draft for circulation among leading scholars and archives. Now, 4 years later, the project is nearing completion. It's my pleasure at this time to introduce the author of this book, Tony Russell.
Is it possible to keep a light on and have the slides? Is it possible to keep a light on and have the slides?
Sure.
Okay, just one light. Thank you. Eleven years ago, when I began a fitful collection of what data I could find about pre-war country music, I had no idea at all that it would come to anything like this. And when at the first I took my pen in hand, as Bunyan remarks in his preface to Paradise Lost, to the Pilgrim's Progress, I did not understand that I at all should make a little book. Well, I share that puzzlement of his, and of course mine is no little book, but at the best recent estimate, something hefting in the same league as the Manhattan Telephone Directory. It all started, of course, in a spirit of mere interest and curiosity, inspired by records like those that Barry Poss was speaking about yesterday, the county reissues and the Folkways Anthology of American Folk Music and albums of that period. My models at the start were the jazz discographies of Brian Rust and the blues and gospel compilation of Bob Dixon and John Godrich, and by and large they've remained my guides ever since, with such alterations as the peculiar nature of hillbilly discography seems to require. It's always appeared to me that discography is a discipline in which conservatism is a very positive virtue, and although a case could be made, and has in the past been made, for amplifying discographies with snippets of biography and copyright data, sales figures, and other such interesting but in the strict term peripheral information, I've decided to adhere to the traditional model because there, at least, one has some chance of approaching to something like completeness. As you've heard, the span of the work is from 1922 to 1942. The former date is determined by the first known recordings of Southern rural music. These were fiddle solos and duets made by Egg Robertson and Henry Gilliland for Victor in New York City. The latter date is very much a discographical convention by now, and is dictated by the virtual cessation of recording with the first Petrillo band of 1942. I realize that this is not an ideal compromise, but it seemed to me useful to observe the same principles as the jazz and blues and gospel books, and besides, to extend the work in either direction would substantially delay its appearance. And although I've enjoyed these 11 years' service, I'm not in the mood to sign up for further fatigues right now. Quite what the scope of the discography is somewhat hard to describe in brief. Essentially, it's anything that can be called white, secular, or religious music that was identified by the recording companies that handled it as old-time, hillbilly, or in some related phrase, or if not so, described generically akin to such music. Some of the terms that you encounter in old catalogues, for example, are old familiar tunes, old time melodies, songs of Dixie, and so forth. Fortunately for the discographer, the bulk of this material was issued in exclusively hillbilly numerical series, such as the Columbia 15,000 series, the OK 45,000s, the Paramount 3,000s, and so forth. One has to assume, I think, that the fact of being marketed as a hillbilly record does give an item a primary claim to be included in a discography of hillbilly music, though there are several cases where this rule of thumb has to be abandoned, as when race or popular items were so issued, for reasons that 50 years on it's very difficult to appreciate. As a matter of fact, these criteria, based upon the original marketing principles of the record companies, do seem to accord pretty well with the judgments of present-day students and collectors. Much hillbilly material, however, was issued outside the confines of these numerical enclaves. Jeanette's hillbilly recordings appeared in general series along with race and popular material. In the first slide. This is a sheet from Jeanette's files showing a section of the Electra Beam 6000 series with a typical mixture of probably, I can't see it from here, blues, jazz, and popular material along with the country. This is a sheet of the kind that I've been through thousands of, showing a section of the New York Master Series of Jeanette's studios, including, as before, hillbilly items mixed in with others. Victor and Bluebird similarly presented much of their hillbilly material in non-exclusive catalog series. One way of pinpointing such material is by referring to the session sheets, which fortunately are still held by RCA. These customarily identify a session as by race or OFT, which I take to refer to old familiar talent. Another slide. This is a session sheet for, again, I hope, the Johnson County Ramblers, a very obscure group, no doubt from East Tennessee. Thanks. And this by the Tennessee Hillbilly. This is an interesting, though fortunately not very common, hillbilly discographical crux. The one item from this session that was actually issued was issued under the name of Maynard's Mountaineers, another act entirely, and coupled with a recording actually by Maynard's Mountaineers. So had this session sheet not survived, we would be left with a single maverick item that didn't sound like the rest of Maynard's Mountaineers' output, and no way of identifying the face behind the mask. Similar session sheets, not quite so expansive in their informative content, exist for much of the ARC recording of the 30s, such as the sheets preserved in the files of veteran talent scout Art Satherley, the sheet for one of the Carter family's last sessions. Next one. And the Crowder brothers from around Asheville were unfortunate enough to make a large number of sides that were either unreleasable or at any rate were unreleased. Typically, you will find no specific personnel data on these sheets, though you may find an instrumentation. There's also some chance that the given dates are not always wholly accurate. These are some of the slighter problems. Some of the more colorful complexities of hillbilly discography are supplied by what I think of as the maverick labels, one-offs, custom jobs, releases by radio stations, or records circulated in very small areas. There are enough of these that we know about to suggest that there may be quite a lot more that we don't know about and have yet to light upon. An issue on the Fireside Melodies label by some popular radio entertainers from around Charleston, West Virginia. We do happen to know that these were custom made by Jeanette, and we therefore have file data on other sides made by the group at the same time, from which we can reasonably deduce that there may well be more Fireside Melodies records out there to be found. This item, as it happens, comes from the collection of Grandpa Jones, was recently donated to the Country Music Foundation. Next one. This is a record label of some interest about which we're really quite well informed. It was a small enterprise run by a businessman from Richlands, Virginia, called W.E. Myers. And the three known releases on the label are probably only sold in southwestern Virginia. Myers had the fervent belief that Jimmy Rogers and his blue yodel were malevolent influences upon country music, hence the logo there. The records were custom made by Paramount, recorded in their Chicago studios. Put up the next one. I know next to nothing about this one, assuming it's Electrovox. It's Ezra of the Beverly Hillbillies, and one can presume that it was made on the West Coast in the later 30s.
Electrovox is still in business.
Thank you.
The recording studio in Los Angeles, they're still in business.
Well,
Mark
thanks.
Scott Schultz, the man who owns the company.
Thank you. Next one. Right, McGregor and Solly, well known to many of you, I imagine, as a company dealing in transcriptions. Some of you may also be familiar with the LPs from their archives, recently put out by Glendale Records in California. This cowboy item, however, and at least one other of related material, seems to have been issued, at least on the face of it, for something like general sale. This is an important distinction for my work because transcriptions, made for broadcast use but not offered for sale to the public, are not being included in the discography, chiefly because most of what is being included is a genuinely commercial release, and also because the field of transcriptions is still too little known, both so far as its extent is concerned and the general background of transcription recording. And I suppose I should mention that for related reasons, I'm not including any material recorded for archival purposes, for instance by the Library of Congress or any other folkloric concerns. Such material raises very serious problems of definition. It also increases the size of the work beyond any reasonable limits and requires a great deal more work to bring it up even to the standard of discographical accuracy, such as it is that the other material has attained. This sort of release opens up a can of beans of indefinable depth. Several radio stations are known to have issued records under their own aegis, and it's quite likely that a good many more will be discovered to have done so. This one, of course, has additional interest to the collector and the student of hillbilly music, as one of the earliest recordings of Jimmy Davis, later Governor Jimmy Davis, in his blue yodeling days before he concentrated upon sacred material. Station KWKH also had OK do a custom recording of the station owner, W.K. Henderson's famous diatribe against chain stores, which began with his well-known introduction, "Hello world, doggone you." Next slide. Thanks to a folklorist, Kip Lornell, we know quite a bit about this label too. Elder Harris was a Baptist minister from Indian Valley, Virginia, who put a couple of traditional hymns, sung most uncommonly to his own fiddle accompaniment, on this recording, which was custom made in New York by the Consolidated Record Company at some time in the early 30s. He also went to the trouble of circulating this leaflet, but despite this elaborate publicity campaign, only a handful of copies of the record are known. Information culled from all these sorts of sources, together with listening to several thousands of recordings and research through catalogues, supplements, songbooks, and folios, and sometimes a bit of, I hope, fairly restrained guesswork, brings us almost to the finished typescript entry. But one vital link in the discographical chain is still left, and that's the first-hand information that one can gain from the musicians themselves. This is often, of course, the most rewarding stage of the work, since it provides information that one could get no other way, and often surprising data that one couldn't even have guessed at, like, for example, chance one-time guest appearances by other musicians that went unacknowledged in company files or on record labels. It also proves to be a source of surprise and pleasure for the musicians themselves to know that somebody is sufficiently interested in what they were doing 40 and 50 years ago to want to document it and to make some permanent record of their contribution to American music. So by this somewhat tortuous route, we arrive at the finished artist or group discography. At present, my most accurate projection suggests that we'll end up with about 2,400 entries, of which a little over a quarter are merely cross-references or one or two-line explanations of pseudonyms used on subsidiary labels. The size of an entry can range from a single item or coupling up to as many as almost 1,500 items. I need hardly add that that particular monster is the distressingly prolific Vernon Dalhart. Quite the most thorny section of this work is the recordings of what we've come to think of as the City Billies, Dalhart, Carson Robinson, Frankie Marvin, Frank Luther, the McCravey brothers, and a few others of that ilk. Not only were they enormously productive, some of them also had a remarkable tendency to sound quite like each other, which is particularly tiresome when they use, as they regularly do, a vast array of pseudonyms. Frankie Marvin, for instance, who was the Frankie Wallace that a questioner yesterday was asking about, was also George White, Ray Ball, and half a dozen other noms de disque. Sorting out all of that constitutes one of the most sustained exercises in dogged attentiveness that this project has offered. Here's the next slide. This is probably not a typical entry. I don't know that I could readily come up with such a thing. The problems are so varied from time to time. But it seems to be a rather poignant one, if this is George E. Harris.
Right.
Okay. Well, here we have this virtual obscurity, who seems to have had four songs, which he determinedly trucked around every recording company that would listen to him, almost nobody doing anything with them, except Columbia finally in despair issues two of them, and they virtually don't sell, and Harris sinks back into the obscurity from which he came and in which he's resided ever since. Let's look at another slightly less depressing one. Now, this is something a little more like a full dress entry, in that being composed partly of Jeanette recordings, it involves a wealth of pseudonyms and cross-couplings, variations in artist credits, speculative dating, and other trifling cruises of hillbilly discography. The layout for those interested in that is basically that of Dixon and Godrich or of Rust, with a few small refinements. No discography obviously can hope to be exhaustive in its first edition, but I think I can claim that this work will, at the least, not fall very far below the standards set by the first editions of Rust's jazz volumes or of Godrich and Dixon's blues and gospel records. And in some respects, I think it may go one or two better. This is no tribute to the compiler, but rather an acknowledgement of how quickly discographical knowledge and know-how have advanced in the last decade. It's a tribute, too, to the contributions of many private collectors and independent researchers who have been collaborating in this project almost since its inception. In addition, I've been a good deal luckier than my compatriots in having access to the library of the Country Music Foundation, which is a very fine and enviably full collection of primary material. Records, of course, but also files and ledgers, songbooks, catalogues, and other source material. Consequently, I've been able actually to inspect and listen to a much larger percentage of what I'm dealing with, I fancy, than my predecessors in the jazz and blues fields were able to command. I think I really only need to add then that the work is considerably better than 75% completed, and that we all, the Foundation and myself, look forward to being able to announce a publication date soon.
I suppose we have a moment for questions, if anyone has any to ask. They do want you to go to the mic and ask them, if that's all right. Thank you. Guess we'll keep it.
Yes.
Do I assume that this discography is going to be only of American country music, or is it going to attempt to include Canadian country music as well?
At present, the only Canadian country music that we've deemed appropriate for inclusion is that Canadian country music that instantly ceased being just Canadian country music, which is to say Hank Snow and Wilf Carter, who seem to me successfully to have immersed themselves almost from the start in the mainstream of American country music, such as it's defined by the discography. There is a case for including some other people, which I'd be interested to discuss in detail.
Perhaps. We have a very strong country tradition in Canada.
Oh, yes.
If the National Library of Canada, of which I'm the head of the sound recording collection, has a lot of old-time country music, And if there's anything that we can do to help share the information about what we have, we'd be quite happy to aid you.
Thank you very much.
There's quite a strong country tradition in Quebec especially, and it's I think a lot of Americans are surprised to hear country music in French.
Yes, but, I'm aware of some of that. Again, it's the rather unsatisfactory answer, but the practical one has to be that limits had to be set somewhere, and a sort of combination of what seemed appropriate to the subject matter and what would be deemed appropriate by the collectors and libraries using the book would initially, at any rate, in a first edition, would be simply straightforward American-recorded American country music.
And one last thing. There are some researchers in Canada who have been working on both Canadian and American country music, and I'm not sure whether you would know about their work or not. Do you know of Bill Leger in Mississauga, Ontario?
Yes, and I have used Alex Robertson's files on Canadian numericals for discovering Canadian issues of American recordings.
You probably know about Bob Fuller in Quebec, too,
yes,
I assume.
Yes, I do.
Then there's something called Maple Music in London, Ontario, that Gary, Wally Fidenchuk has done, which might occasionally help you out, especially with some of the fiddle repertoire. If you do want some help from the National Library, please approach us, because we're very anxious to promote any Canadian content we can get wedged into your work.
Thanks very much, and that's precisely the kind of response I was hoping that this presentation would elicit. So if anybody else wants to make similar offers, we'd be very glad to hear them.
Yeah, I'm Paul Jackson. I'm curious. We're working with a publisher who's publishing the pirated recordings of the Beatles, and they're looking for fanzines. And I'm wondering, will your discography include any information about your sources, such as fanzines?
In the preface to the work, I think we will give at least a highly compressed account of the sorts of source material that we've been using, and certainly the early fanzines of the late 30s and early 40s have been very valuable sources of personnel and related information. Whether we can go into anything like a history of hillbilly fanzines rather than a simple acknowledgement of their existence and of our debt to them, I rather doubt. But we can at least define our sources.
One other question. Have you run across such things as in the archives of the label companies, have you run across notes of phone conversations? This is something that which we at Motown Records ran across and found to be very helpful in source material, knowing who they were talking with about what projects and so forth.
I haven't come across company file information in that depth, no. Almost all the companies who have preserved any kind of substantial file material on their own past seem at some stage within the last 20 or 25 years to have had a pretty rigorous clear out in which what was deemed then to be essential information, like in some cases sales figures or at any rate a mere bare documentation of their holdings, would be preserved, and anything not directly usable anymore, or so they thought, would be thrown away. So in many cases, there is really very little left except the very barest bones of a company archive.
Okay, thank you.
My name is Morty Savada, and as a follow-up first question to this previous gentleman, will there be any LP listings of the originals?
Not without a twinge of regret. I have elected to follow the practice of, certainly of the Blues and Gospel book, and I think probably of Rust's discographies, of not including any issues on LPs, except those items which were only issued on LPs, which were unissued at the time on 78, and exist now only as so-called reissues.
Okay.
The goal in all these things seems to have been fixed years ago as completeness, and once you start including LPs, you're dealing with an unending process. The solution often seems to be that some sort of accompanying booklet updated at regular intervals be produced, and I think we've had some talk. We have discussed the possibility of supplying this handbook to the discography through the Country Music Foundation Press.
Seems to be a good solution to that.
Sure.
Number two, what sort of indices do you expect to have in the back? Names, songs?
There'd certainly be a name index so that people can trace accompanying work and the movement of artists from group to group, though some of that information will be provided in footnotes to the specific discographies. A song title index has been suggested. I'm not sure if a decision has been reached about whether one be included.
We're planning on doing that.
We're planning on doing that.
You are. Very good.
Thank you. A matrix index?
No, I fancy not. Now, we are assuming that a very large proportion of the people using this book in its first edition will be people sufficiently acquainted with discographical practice not to need some of the indices that people entirely unfamiliar with the subject might think necessary. This may not be a satisfactory solution, but there again, we're trying to publish a book at a reasonable price and a reasonable size.
Could you make a few comments about the peripheries that, how far you're extending in terms of related material? For example, Cajun, how much Cajun material will be included? On people like Vernon Dalhart, where their repertoire extends into clearly non-country music, what's going to be the criterion for cutoff? And other artists who record country music and not country music, what kind of, where are you going to distinguish what to include and what not?
Okay, to take the second part of the question first. There are fortunately not too many artists, of course, who range very widely across both country and non-country fields. Those that do, typically Dalhart and a couple of the other city billies, Robeson and Marvin. The policy, I think, will be to include as much as possible without going grossly beyond the bounds of what the most generous stylistic definer would call country music. And with Dalhart, the problem is relatively simple in that his popular work largely preceded in a neat block his hillbilly work, or pseudo-hillbilly work. And we can simply start Dalhart's discography at about the point that he suddenly discovers the wreck of the old 97 fame, fortune, and hillbilly popularity, and continue it to the end without, I think, including very much highly peripheral material. If there should be cases of people who constantly jumped from one idiom to the other, I think we'll just have to arrive at a probably not entirely satisfactory distinction between country and acceptably peripherally country material and quite unacceptably popular material. But I don't think that's a problem that occurs too often. As for Cajun music, this is the one ethnic group music that we will include, partly because it's very much a subject of interest for those people that are also interested in country music outside it. Also because it was recorded along with and in according to all the same principles as the hillbilly material and marketed in a related or sometimes indistinguishable fashion. It's also quite a handleable size of material, and we've got all the information. It seems a pity to exclude it, though I gather that Richard Spotswood in his ethnic discography will also be including it. So. It's chiefly a sort of compromise with what a strict definition of country music might be thought to be and what one can see a large proportion of the users of the book preferring to have in it.
Going towards that point, will you be including novelty groups that were sold towards the country audience, for instance, the Hoosier Hotshots and groups like that?
Yes. There's also been a sort of sliding scale of acceptability over the last 10 or 11 years. I started out with the fond hope that one could exclude Dalhart and the Hoosier Hotshots and everything. Not because I don't like them, but because it does substantially increase the work. And at the time, tastes seem not to require that they be included. Well, times and tastes have changed, and there are quite a lot of novelty groups sort of that kind being included. I think most people will find that the general policy is liberal, perhaps even over-generous. I hope they find it it's that way rather than the other way anyway.
This time about 5 minutes or less for our inevitable stage change up here and then begin the next presentation. Thank you.